In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I are going to be talking about whether to sell your app, how to run a smoke test, and a question about mobile game marketing. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 123. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Mike?
So we have two new MicroConf sponsors. We picked up PicFu and Tea Leaf Academy. PicFu is a lightweight marketing polling software application for logo designs, marketing material, product ideas. And the Tea Leaf Academy is an online boot camp for learning how to develop web applications.
Many thanks to PicFu and Tea Leaf Academy. While we're talking about MicroConf, we have a couple of speakers that have been in the works for a month or so have finally confirmed. Josh Kaufman, who's the author of best-selling book Personal MBA, and he also runs a website, personalmba.com. I really enjoyed this book. It's a long kind of compendium that covers a lot of topics, and so some of the topics didn't apply to me, but a lot of them were very well covered. So we're pleased to have Josh, and he's going to be covering like idea validation, vetting an idea, and some processes for doing that. So I'm super excited to hear from Josh. And the other speaker is Joanna Wiebe from Copy Hackers. I bet a lot of people in the audience know her. She's been on TechZing and MixerG, and Copy Hackers is a series of books that she wrote on copywriting for startups. So excited to hear what she has to say as well.
Very cool.
What else is new?
Well, I've got a early access customer scheduled for next week who's going to be going through some of the Linux auditing that I've got set up. I still need to implement SSH keys, but over the past couple of days, I've been working pretty hard on the Linux stuff, and that stuff seems like it's all working right now. So I just need to implement the SSH keys that'll allow them to essentially restrict how the application gets onto their machines and where it's going to come in from, because they have IP address restrictions as well. So it'll only be able to come in from my servers using these particular keys. I've had a couple of different conversations with two really large customers over the past 2 weeks who have auditing needs. One of them's a local municipal government, which has 15,000 employees, and the other one's a public company. And both of them are having the exact same problem, and it's along the lines of what Audit Shark is intended to do. So I hadn't planned on implementing some of this functionality for a while, but when given customer demand, you kind of do what needs to be done. So I'll be looking at how to add that functionality in and pick up those guys as customers.
And how'd you hook up with those two big gorillas?
One of them found the Audit Shark through the podcast, actually. So there was somebody who was working at the company and found it and kind of forwarded the information to his coworker, who said he'd definitely be interested in talking to me. And then the other one, I did some consulting work for them, and they seemed to be having this problem. I was just talking to them in general about what sort of challenges and stuff they were running into. And the problem came up, had a nice conversation about it. But it turned out that after that one, then this public company came and found me. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that all turns out, though.
The early access is going well. Are you still looking at next week or so to end that? Have you gotten enough feedback yet?
I don't think so. I'm still looking for more. I think that the Linux stuff is going to play into it a lot more than I'd originally thought. There's much more demand for the Linux side of things than there is on the Windows side. The Windows side, it's more of a take a second look at the machines, but it's not real clear what people are really looking for or what they're interested in seeing. Whereas on the Linux side, there are a lot more distributions. There's a lot more clean-cut rules about what sorts of things you should be doing and should be looking at. So I think that the Linux side is definitely going to bring to light a lot more things.
Very good. Yeah, on my end, I have a couple updates. One is that I was originally hoping that I'd be able to launch Drip in early April, but I knew that if it slipped at all, that I wouldn't be able to launch it until after MicroConf, because launching like the second week of April is just not possible given how much, you know, time is required and mental energy is required to put on MicroConf. So over the last couple of months, we have either iterated on a few things or we have added enough features to kick it just over the edge. So our code complete deadline, like the early access deadline, was April 1 for a while, and it's now April 10. And that's just too far for me to be comfortable with it. So we're still going to start early access at that point. I'm probably going to have it installed on Hittail, and Hittail is going to be using Drip within the next probably 7 to 10 days is the goal. And then once we get through about a week, week and a half of that, and have all the kinks worked out, then we'll start the first early access customer, and then probably bring a few more on in April. But the launch that where it goes public, goes live, will be after MicroConf. And I struggled through this decision, you know, of whether to push it off or not, but it is absolutely the right decision now that I looked at all the pros and cons of it. There are very few reasons not to push it off. It gives us more time to handle things, and we still have a very specific and spelled out project schedule, so it's not as if I'm saying, oh, we're just going to push it off 2 months. It's like we still have milestones that we're hitting every week, and it'll just be better for all of us involved, because I was starting to pull late nights and get stressed out about things. And I think, like you, I always underestimate how much time MicroConf is going to take. Third year, you think I would have learned by now, but it just takes more time than I think it's going to prepare for it.
Yeah, you and I were talking about it earlier, and it's only 6 weeks out at this point, so
yeah, it's crunch time.
Definitely creeping up quick.
Definitely. I also wanted to mention a correction, and our editor actually caught this. She said 2 weeks in a row, you had said that I was quoted in the Wall Street Journal, and I corrected you and said, no, it was the New York Times. Well, it is the Wall Street Journal, so I shouldn't have corrected you. This week, we are answering a bunch of listener questions. We have some really good listener questions in the queue. I'm excited about it. Our first question is from Dan Taylor, and he says, hi guys, long-term fan here. Here's a question for the show. My situation is that I, along with two minority partners, developed Course Director, which is a SaaS app for schools and colleges that integrates with Google Apps and is sold via the Google Apps Marketplace. We've built it into a respectable five-figure income. We have a recurring revenue model of charging a certain amount per user per year. The current reality is we have all now got too much going on with our main projects, and the time we are taking to support our clients and add new features, and in general, it's just getting to be too much. So we've all looked at all our options in detail and decided we would definitely like to sell our app, which for someone currently in the education space, it could easily be a six-figure income. Someone based in the US would be have a much easier time with the business just for starters, as a majority of the customers are there. So you've talked before about buying an app. Wanted to find out if you had any thoughts about selling an app. Cheers, and love the show. Dan. The thing I want to point out is that, remember last episode we talked about one of the launch mistakes, and it's not growing your startup fast enough so that you lose interest? That's basically what looks like has happened here, right? It's like you have an app and it's kind of successful, and that actually sucks more than having an app that's not successful at all. Because if you have an app that's not successful at all, you can shut it down and move on, and you don't feel bad. You don't feel bad letting customers down. You don't feel bad about all the revenue you're leaving on the table. And Dan's in a tough situation. It's almost worse to have some success than it is to have none, because now he's in the situation of like what to do with this app. So I think before I tried to sell it, I would look at automating this as much as possible, and whether that means writing some code or hiring like a product manager or a general manager or someone to help run the app, depending on how much revenue is coming in and depending on how much time it actually takes, I would look at that first, because selling an app is not trivial, especially if this thing's making five figures a year and you want 1, 2, 3 times annual revenue. That's a non-trivial purchase price, and so it's going to take a long time, and you're going to need to find the exact right buyer. You could always throw it up on Flippa and try to get 12 to 18 months revenue, but in this price range, it's not going to be an easy sell. So that's the first thing I'd entertain. It's always easier. It's like an easy out to sell, and I know people just want to cut ties and walk away, and it would feel really good not to have to worry about it at all. But that's not always the right choice. I mean, I think you really have to ask yourself the question, if I could find someone who was maintaining this and doing a really good job, and it was kind of throwing off a dividend for me, would I prefer to do that rather than let this go at probably a bargain basement price? Because to be honest, apps are bought, not sold. What I mean by that is, if you go to sell an app, the odds of you getting more than 12 to 18 months of net profit are pretty low. It does happen, but in general, it's just going to be tough going cold into a market, especially if you need high-touch sales, and I'm not sure if you do or not with this app. And if you decide you do, in fact, want to sell, it's just a matter of looking at some good Flippa auctions that have done a good job and maybe modeling your post after theirs, providing a lot of information, being very honest up front, and not having too high expectation, you know, for what you're planning to get in terms of price. In addition, the last chapter of my book, Start Small, Stay Small, covers this. It's just, you know, maybe 10 pages, but it covers in detail how I would go about selling an app, and it actually has a sample listing for Flippa.
Part of the challenge he's running into is the fact that it's not just him, but it's him and two minority partners. So there are these other people who are involved, and they probably have some sort of decision-making ability into it. And the problem is, as you said, it seems like it's more like burnout than anything else, but there's a big gap in the five-figure annual income. And if you look at the average price point here is $1,500 a year. Well, it doesn't take very many customers in order to hit $1,500 a year. And if you go look on Course Director, there's 28 verified reviews and 39 regular reviews. So you could probably guesstimate and say, okay, well, he's probably got 60 customers, something like that. But that's still about $75,000 a year. It's not enough for one person to live on, but with some effort and work, it could be. But, you know, how do you shake off those other partners? I mean, that maybe that's another option, is to find a way to have one of the partners buy out the other two.
Right, and even potentially using revenue from the app if you're motivated to do so.
Right, and that could get around the potential problem of dragging out a sale for 6 months or a year or 2 years trying to find a potential buyer who would be a good fit.
Right. I quickly jumped to the conclusion that he should post it on Flippa, but that's probably not the first thing I would do. If you do, in fact, decide to sell, I would find your strategics, right? Find the companies who would benefit the most from this and reach out to them and probably do cold emails or calling and say, hey, I have an app and it's for sale on a limited market, you know, and try to sell it to them first before you just go to the broader market, because the broader market really is a more of a wholesale price. And if you can find someone who actually has strategic value for this app, I think you'll do a lot better with it.
Yeah. And to find people like that who you could potentially approach and sell, there are publicly available lists of approved vendors for each state. So what you would do is you would probably go find one of those approved vendors. They are allowed to sell typically through like a bulk purchasing. So for example, I live in Massachusetts, and I'm sure that there's a publicly available list where I can go there and say, okay, well, can the state or federal agencies who are based here buy from such and such vendor, because they have to be listed there in order to use some of their prearranged purchasing agreements. And you could just go down the list and see which of those in one or multiple states kind of fits the criteria for a company that you might want to sell a Course Director to. That's probably where I would start for looking for that kind of thing.
So thanks for the question, Dan. I hope that helps. Our next question is on smoke testing. And this is from Alex. He says, I'm an indie consultant getting ready to experiment with MVPs for some products of my own. According to the Lean methodology, I should or could set up a landing page with a buy now for 99 cents button and have that redirect not to a shopping cart, since there's really nothing to purchase at this time, but to an email signup form. But what do I tell my potential customer on that email signup form? Do I, one, tell them they're part of a product experiment, which is the truth, two, tell them that the product isn't done quite just yet, a half-truth, or three, we're overloaded with business right now, and if you give us your email, we'll put you in line, a lie. What are your feelings, thoughts, and experiences with this dilemma?
I think my first thought is, where's the fourth option that basically says that you're trying to validate the idea and with enough interest? I mean, because the first one is pretty close, I think. It says, tell them they're part of a product experiment. But when you're putting content like that on a website, I think that by saying exactly that, that you're going to turn people away and you're going to get a much lower conversion rate to begin with, because people don't like to be guinea pigs. Even though they are on a daily basis, they don't like being told flat out that they're guinea pigs. So what I would do is I would say, you know, you're validating this product idea, and assuming there's enough interest, you're going to move forward with it. You don't want to come out and say, hey, you're part of a product experiment. Please give us your email address.
I also question how you're going to sell a 99-cent product, or how you're going to vet a 99-cent product using landing pages. I've never heard of that being done. I think that the minimum price to really do this, or to consider using the marketing kind of the funnel approach where you drive traffic to a page and you convert it either to emails at this stage or to purchases eventually. I mean, there's just a minimum purchase price where that works, because otherwise you need absolute free traffic. So I guess if you had a bunch of SEO and were sending people to it and you could convert one out of 100, maybe, you know, then you're making 99 cents per 100 visitors, which is just a tiny, tiny amount. So I think unless your lifetime value of your customer is a lot higher than 99 cents, I just question the value of a smoke test at all. I haven't seen it done with price points that are this low. So Alex, if you do this and you know, you find out that it does or doesn't work, we'd love to hear back from you.
If you had to guess, what would your minimum price point be?
Yeah, I was going to say $19 one time or like between $5 and $10 a month SaaS. I think anything less than either of those, unless you have extenuating circumstances, like you have in-app purchases that actually mean you'll have a higher lifetime value. I think the rules start bending on the edge cases, right? It's like if you have a $3 one-time purchase product or you have a $10,000 one-time purchase product, I just don't think this approach works as well because one is high touch and one is so low touch that you can't even really afford to test it.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks, Alex. I hope that helps. Our next question is from Joe Hopkins, and it's a question about whether mobile gaming follows our marketing rules. He says, "Hi, Rob and Mike. Love your show. Discovered it a few weeks ago and have since gone back and listened to most of the episodes. I left my job about a year ago to focus on my bootstrap mobile game business, and I have found your podcast to be very helpful and much more applicable than other podcasts that focus on larger VC-backed startups with no revenue. What are your thoughts on how your podcast relates to mobile gaming? Does your marketing advice apply to casual gaming that generates revenue by selling $1 games? Should I look into marketing funnels and acquisitions a la episode 112, or am I playing in a different game? Currently, my business generates most of its revenue from one hit game that generates a humble $100 a day. Thanks." And Joe is from doubletapsoftware.com.
I'd have to say that most of the stuff that we talk about is probably not applicable to the mobile gaming environment. I'd almost have to go so far as to say that most of the stuff that we talk about is probably not applicable to the majority of the mobile environment to begin with. I mean, I certainly don't have any experience, you know, selling mobile games, and I would have a hard time giving somebody advice to say, oh, this stuff is going to work for you in this environment. I mean, you can certainly try it. And if it works, great. If it doesn't, then you at least tried something new.
Yeah, the tough part with giving advice and being focused, the more focused your advice gets, the fewer people it actually applies to. And I think over time, if you look back to our early episodes, we really did include a big swath of people. We include mobile and we included web and probably even desktop. But as time has gone on, the audience, I think, has shaped around web apps and a lot of SaaS apps and some one-time download stuff. But for the most part, a lot of questions that come in really specifically are about SaaS apps and web apps. And so a lot of what we do talk about absolutely applies to that kind of app. And as you break out of there and get past the edges, like you said, mobile, I think a good chunk of what we talk about works, but probably not the funnel stuff, the funnel optimization, because it's sold in such a different way because the app store model is different. But if you think of optimizing for iTunes, like optimizing for Google in terms of just getting traffic in, and then if you think of your listing in the iTunes App Store or the Android App Store as your marketing website, then the fundamental stuff that we discuss still applies there, but maybe not the exact tactic that we talk about when we talk about, you know, including a video demo or whatever, you know, on your website. Obviously, you can't do that in the iTunes App Store. But if you go one step further than a lot of your competitors, and instead of just having some basic screenshots of your app, you actually have kind of a marketing website that you build within that little iOS App Store frame, people who just do a better job of marketing their app, right? So the bottom line is, I think in general, what we say applies to both mobile and web and desktop, but there certainly are some specifics that won't. And I think the things you called out, like having a marketing funnel and being able to pay for ads and that kind of stuff, it just doesn't work with 99 cent lifetime values. Gaming is another animal altogether, and almost none of what we say applies to gaming because gaming is a hit-based business. You're going to hear more pertinent information if you talk to like a record executive or someone building movies or TV shows because they're not bought on value, right? And we talk mostly about things that are bought or sold on value. That means that they saved someone time, make them money, or save them money.
Yeah, one of the problems that I've seen, as you said, is it's a hit-based business. But even with some of the games that I've bought for my phone, I mean, I've looked through at some of the other games that have been developed by the same developer, and a lot of them I just don't like. So they'll come out with a great game, and then I look to see what other things that they have, and a lot of the other stuff just isn't as good or isn't something I'm interested in. I mean, the only thing that I can think of as a strategy would be to find a hit game that you've developed and then build related apps around it that do similar things, that have a similar type of gameplay, but are not exactly the same thing. I think Rovio did a really good job with expanding their Angry Birds franchise and making all these different variations of what is essentially the same game. And that might work very well in the mobile space. I don't know how well it would work in like a desktop game space. But obviously there's a lot of games that come out where you have sequels to them and they take years to develop. But I think with a mobile space, you might do a lot better churning out some of those games that are very much related, share a lot of the same code base.
Yeah, and Patrick Thompson from Inkstone Software, who has QuickReader that I mentioned last week, he has built a portfolio, a nice little portfolio of related apps. Now, they're not games, but it is in the mobile space. And he did a talk at Portland Mobile Users Group that was fascinating, and it actually linked up pretty well with a lot of what you and I talk about on the podcast. There were one or two places where we diverged, and that's because mobile is different from the web. But for the most part, a lot of the stuff that we talk about here, he basically confirmed is true and works well within the mobile space.
And there's a link to that talk on the last podcast episode.
So thanks for your question, Joe. Our next question is from Mike Nava, and he says, "Hey guys, wanted to drop you a note and tell you how nice to stumble across your podcast a few weeks ago." He has a long email, so I will summarize. He says, "My concern is, as a startup with an, I think, cool idea that solves a problem, how much do I put out there? I do not want someone to take the idea and start their own before I have a chance to develop it fully. So let's say I'm at MicroConf in April and I talk about what I'm developing. Is that safe? I guess everyone's there to help one another and learn, but maybe you can understand the paranoia as who knows when I will have another idea as good as this one. Anyway, keep up the great podcast. I'll be listening."
I have a couple of different thoughts on that. The first one is nobody's going to steal your idea. And the second one is nobody cares about stealing your idea. And the reason they don't care about stealing your idea is because it's not successful. The second you're successful with it, everybody and their mother is going to want to steal it. But until you've proven it, nobody is going to care. You can talk about it for months or years on end and nobody's going to bother because you haven't proven it yet. And you know, you can look all over the web and ask how much my idea is worth, and everyone's going to tell you it's worthless. It's the implementation of that idea that's worth money. And until you've proven that the idea is viable and that people are willing to pay for it, I don't think you have anything at all to worry about.
And I also think there's a fine line between talking to a few people at a conference or a few people maybe online versus projecting it on a podcast live to thousands of people or blogging about it and detailing your entire marketing approach, right? It's like you definitely need to keep some stuff under your vest, especially what you have as a competitive advantage. You should have something as a competitive advantage. And so you don't want to give all of that away. But talking about an idea and just getting more feedback on it, I've never heard of anyone stealing an idea like that. We're all way too busy with our own ideas that we think are great.
Yeah, I mean, how long have I talked about Audit Shark in this podcast? And I have yet to see anyone out there who has come to me and said, "Hey, Mike, somebody stole your Audit Shark idea." I mean, it's just, I haven't seen that yet. And I think it's, you know, partially because nobody wants to steal an idea that's unproven.
Right. And the value that you're going to get from discussing it with other founders or hopefully even other potential customers, because they're the real important ones, right? It's like discussing with founders might get you some good feedback, but if we're not the target market, then there's not nearly as much value as actually going and talking about it with customers. So I would even err on the side of looking for customers rather than just talking about it with other founders. Our next question is from Leonard Teo. He says, "I'm a big fan of your blog and a micropreneur of sorts. My small consulting side business has grown into a 3-person company at ballistic.com. My question for you that has burned in my mind since starting, what is your advice for micropreneurs wanting to take vacation? For example, I built an app in my spare time earlier this year, and I'm afraid to actually launch it because I also became a father and have had to take extended periods of time off work. When I'm actually around, I can provide support within 48 to 72 hours, but what about when you need to take a week or two off? What do you do? I have two other friends in the same boat. They bring their laptops on vacation, find themselves having to work, and are burned out and depressed. Really appreciate your thoughts. Thanks in advance."
It sounds to me like there's not necessarily enough automation to make going on vacation viable. And, you know, just the comment about my friends are in the same boat, they bring their laptops on vacation and find themselves having to work and are burned out and depressed, that just strikes me as a situation where there is not enough automation such that it can be handed off to somebody else to take care of, I think is a problem. I mean, that's probably the start of the problem, and that's where you've got to focus some resources. Because if you don't have processes and procedures in place for other people to follow, then you'll never be able to take a vacation. And it won't matter whether that vacation is something you planned or something that, you know, just came up out of the blue and it is an emergency where you've got to go, you know, maybe somebody's in the hospital or maybe you end up in the hospital. I mean, what happens at that point? Is there any way for you to hand off the business to somebody else and say, hey, I need you to run this on effectively autopilot for a little while I go deal with this other situation? So I would treat a vacation as really no different than that, but you really need to focus some time and effort and energy into automating enough stuff so that's possible. I mean, if you're taking your laptop on your vacation just because you're afraid of what can happen, there's probably not enough automation, or you're just too afraid to take that vacation. To kind of test this out, what you could do is just not respond to emails for 2 days. And it doesn't have to be, you know, a week, just make it for 2 days. And I don't mean over a weekend. I mean in like a, you know, a Tuesday to a Thursday or something like that. And not answer emails and see what happens. And I can almost guarantee that the world is not going to end. I mean, you'll at least be able to come back to those on Thursday. And the reality is, even for business applications, a lot of people do not expect a turnaround time of 2 hours. They appreciate it, but at the same time, when are you going to live your life? Why are you building this business? And if you're not building the business for yourself, then what's the point?
Yeah, my thoughts are hire a VA. Like, hire a VA as soon as you can, because what you've built is, it sounds like you've built a job rather than a business. And if you want a job, you know, you can probably go make more money working for someone else. It's not having a business that you can step away from even for a week or two. I don't even think that's really a business. There's a book called Built to Sell that I'd highly recommend you reread if you haven't already. It's a little bit cheesy. It's told as like a fable, but the concepts in it are sound, and it's about building a business that is more automated, that has processes, and it's something that you can step away from. And the funny thing is once you build your business up to where it's actually saleable and it really is a solid business, you probably won't want to sell it, because at that point, then it's basically throwing off cash, and you're going to enjoy working on it so much more because you're able to work on it rather than in the business. I just think that hiring a VA or hiring someone to handle the stuff that you're doing day to day, it has to be your first step. It reminds me of, I remember the old micro ISV movement, and there were so many people in that movement who were talking about, oh, it's, you know, it's so hard because I work 12-hour days. And as soon as I started hiring VAs, that's where, like, I realized that you didn't have to do that same old thing, right? You didn't have to do the same old thing of doing everything. Even if you are a one-person software company, you don't have to do everything yourself. You need to get help in there so that you can step away. And I know a number of micropreneurs, myself included, who take a lot of time off, who take way more time off than when we work full-time. And I rarely, if ever, worry about the business having any type of misstep during that time. So I hope that answers your question. Our next one is about whether or not to move to SaaS. And this is from Robert Longley. And he says, love the show. I have a software application for social services that I've sold to a few different organizations. It's installed on their servers, but I would like to start offering it as a SaaS solution. Most smaller agencies don't have the staff or the infrastructure to host it themselves. They also want to customize it beyond their ability to pay for it. A SaaS solution would solve part of the problem, but getting people to standardize is a pain. There's also the issue of liability, since there's a lot of personal data. Any suggestions on best direction given some of these challenges? Thanks, Rob. I have a couple thoughts to start. I do think that SaaS is probably the way to go here, because as you said, I worked for the city of Pasadena, and I did work with the health department and some other departments that just didn't have a lot of funding and didn't have a lot of technical expertise, and their ability to host things wasn't up to snuff. I would think that SaaS is a really good option for these guys. And I also think that their data will be more secure with you rather than less secure, because you're gonna worry about it and you're gonna do the right things in terms of securing their data. Definitely a lot of personal information. So you are absolutely gonna need to have this high security, and therefore you're gonna need to have a price point that supports that, right? You can't charge $9 a month and have exceptional security. You do have to be able to pay for that security, and whether that includes doing it yourself, which is a lot of time, or hiring someone to do it, which involves money, you do need to to make it work, because obviously you don't want to get hacked and lose people's information. Second thing you mentioned is of people wanting to customize it beyond their ability to pay for it. What I would think about is if there's a way to allow them to customize it within the app, if there's a way to build a module that allows them to do most of the customizations that they've asked for in the past. Because obviously, if you move to SaaS, you're not going to have separate code bases for all of these agencies. And my guess is that you will be able to find some type of middle ground that allows people to either configure their account and set up custom fields. I'm assuming custom fields and custom workflows is what they want. You can look at an example like Fogbugs or, you know, something that allows people to set up those custom types of things and see how they've done it. Because obviously they're a SaaS app and they don't have separate code bases for everyone.
Yeah, I think Rob's got a lot of good points. I think one thing you definitely want to focus on is going to the people who are using the older versions of your software and trying to upsell them to a newer version that is hosted by you. And, you know, you can start out those discussions by asking them why they didn't renew or how things are working for them, and try and find out as much information from them before you start pitching them on a new system. Because, you know, you want to use it for two different things. One, you want to use it to find out whether or not they're still using it. You can essentially use those yearly maintenance fees to say, hey, well, if you buy onto this new system, you'll get the full version of the software, you'll get everything that you needed, plus it's going to be continually updated. You're not going to have to worry about upgrades or security or all of these different things. And then you price all of that stuff in there. And you should be able to gradually move some people over. Now, there's going to be this subset of people who are not going to move no matter what, and there's not going to be a lot you can do about them. I would actually draw a line in the sand and try to move completely away from those people who have a hosted version. I think you said that this is it's got a SQL Server backend and it's a web application, but if you're asking these smaller organizations to host that themselves, I mean, it seems like that's just a recipe for disaster when it comes to support costs, because you're going to spend a lot of time and effort with that support that these people are not going to have that expertise, and chances are good that they're going to have to hire somebody to come in anyway. So you can use all of those as part of your sales pitch to tell them, hey, well, you don't have to do this, you don't have to do that. This is the one price that you're going to have to pay, and that's it. So I think that there's a lot of good sales opportunities there. You just really need to work out with some of those customers exactly how you're going to migrate them from their existing system onto the new system.
So thanks for your question, Rob. Hope that was helpful.
If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsforrestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.